This episode was recorded prior to the September release of gross domestic product and personal consumption expenditures data. This data is timely as it supports some of the trends discussed in this episode.
Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. So with that, joining me here today in our New York podcast studio here in 1285, I'm glad to welcome back, sitting across from me, Jason Dreho, the head of asset allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Joining me to my right, very excited to have in person here with us, Ken Kaplan, the Global Co-Chief Investment Officer of Blackstone. So with that, Ken, Jason, it's great to have you both here in person. Plenty to talk about, so looking forward to what will be a productive next 30 minutes.
It's good to be here, Dan. Ken, great to have you the first time.
So. Thank you for inviting me to be part of the podcast.
My pleasure.
Very happy to be here as well.
So let's get right into it. Maybe, Ken, looking at the state of the U.S. economy as it stands today, mindful as well of the Fed's commencement of policy easing measures, which we can get a bit more into a bit later into the conversation. But I'm curious to hear about your expectations for the trajectory of the U.S. economy, namely the prospect for a soft landing, which has been debated a lot in recent time.
Sure. So what we're seeing is consistent, frankly, with what we've been saying, which is that the Fed medicine, you know, has been working. You know, we're obviously in this next phase with this rate cut. But what we've been seeing, and we have this unique vantage point, right, at Blackstone, the scale and scope of the capital, the different businesses, private equity, real estate, you know, credit, our multi-asset strategies, 200-plus portfolio companies, 12,000-plus real estate assets, all the insights and data that we're getting from our credit business. And when we look at what that's been telling us, and what that's been telling us for the better part of this year, is really three main things. First is that, you know, the U.S. economy here being resilient. Right, we're continuing to see, you know, mid-single digit revenue growth across our private equity portfolio companies. We're continuing to see defaults be very low in our credit business. I like to think that's partly our credit selection, but also just low overall. We're seeing that also in strength in parts of the economy. You see that in digital infrastructure. You see that in power. You see that in IT spending. So across a lot of different areas, you're seeing, you know, resilience in the U.S. economy. At the same time, and this is becoming clear to the broader market, but we've been seeing this early, you are seeing slowdown, you are seeing deceleration, right? So we have seen that revenue growth that I mentioned, the mid-single digits, that has come down. We're seeing, you know, obviously in the consumer segment, which I know you've talked about, and we see also, whether it's personal care or apparel or hospitality leisure businesses, you're seeing, you know, some challenges there in those businesses as well. Obviously, on the labor side, where we still have a healthy or balanced labor market, but you know, you're seeing some slowdown, increase in unemployment, easier to fill positions. We see that in our CEO surveys, and in our portfolio companies, easier to hire, and you know, open positions being back to a bit of an equilibrium level. So, resilient economy, but a slowing economy, and obviously positive of that, which also has now coming to the data and given the Fed confidence to cut, we've seen the inflation numbers coming down. And you, again, have seen that in a few different areas, right? You've seen that in wage growth in our portfolio companies, again, where that's now crossed below 4%, which has been on a steady decline. You've seen this in our input costs across our portfolio companies. For over a year now, we've seen less than 1% growth in non-labor input costs, and you see it in shelter, right? The two last legs of inflation were really labor and shelter. The Fed obviously saw the labor numbers coming down and have gotten comfort with shelter, which we know comes in on a lag. So, you know, the combination of that, you know, resilient economy, but slowing economy, and inflation coming down, which is not a bad backdrop for investing. Obviously, we're not the only ones that have seen this. We saw this early. That's why at the beginning of the year, we said now is the time to lean in. Now is the time to invest. And now that's coming into the broader numbers. And it's obviously one of the factors that has given the Fed the confidence to, you know, start cutting and, you know, enter this next chapter in the rate cycle.
I would echo a lot of what Ken is saying. You know, more the broad data we see as opposed to specific company data. You know, you have an economy that is slowing, moderating, but still we think is resilient. Like, so, bottom line, say, we don't think a recession is likely in the next 12 months. So let's say 1 in 4 chance or even less, given the latest data. Feel reasonably comfortable kind of about that. There are certainly kind of lingering concerns, I think primarily on the labor market, but I think, again, we feel confident that it is cooling, not cracking, right, as a simple way to kind of put it. But I'm curious, a couple of things, can you just describing, things slowing, resilient but slowing. One of the kind of broader debates, and I think we'll get into the more longer term, is, are we slowing from an elevated level to something as normal, or is it outright deterioration? Because when you, in real time, as you see things kind of going lower, you don't know, like, are you lowering in a way that sort of then going to plateau, to like an elevated level, or is it going to kind of, is the curve the other way that you're going and you're going to fall off a cliff?
It feels more like normalization to us. And that's what we're seeing. If you see some of the excesses that you had, post-COVID, now more normalizing. Again, the labor market's probably a good example of that, where you're now more in an equilibrium, easier to fill the positions that were harder. We'll see where things go. But, 4% or the 4% range is not a bad level for unemployment. You're still seeing, wage growth, but that wage growth is moderating. Now, we'll see what that direction of travel is, but it feels like more like a moderation, normalization than a falling off a cliff, as you said.
So picking up on the labor market, you mentioned like the CEO survey you do, it's easier to fill positions.
Yeah.
It's interesting when you look at the labor market overall, headline number of job growth is definitely coming down. Some of this could be some noise and seasonal adjustments in the summer. In a week and a half, we'll get the September payrolls report. At the same time, so hiring is definitely moderated. Job openings have come down, but layoffs remain incredibly low.
Yep.
And we were recording this on Thursday morning. Earlier today, about an hour ago, the weekly initial jobless claims out, the lowest in 4 months. So we're actually seeing a moderation there. Yep. So when I look at the labor market overall, it almost feels like it's a little bit of like, not a game of chicken, but like you have companies who are reluctant to hire, but they're also not laying off people.
Yes.
And it's like everyone's like, things are good enough that we don't want to lay off people. And usually you don't lay off people until like things are really bad. At the same time, we're not quite sure yet just how good the economy is going to be to like, we want to kind of ramp up hiring. So it's almost like it feels like a holding pattern until either you see the rate cuts kind of benefiting, or you're convinced as a CEO that, the soft landing is legit. I need to have confidence, and then I can start planning to hire. And this may be more of the 25 story. So that's kind of my observation when I look at the data in aggregate. When you get this kind of the CEO,
I'd say consistent with that. And you can see it in the numbers. Our headcount growth in our portfolios has been pretty flat to very modestly increasing. And it's all consistent with all the things that you're saying. You're easier to fill the positions. And when you look at the open positions back to, around pre-COVID, equilibrium levels. When you look at, again, the wage growth, sub 4%, still, way down from where it was, but, not at some, deteriorating levels. When you look at headcount, pretty flat to sub 3% headcount growth overall, which again is a stable type level. So it's very consistent with what you've been saying, and we'll see where that, goes as you look forward.
So I wrote a note early in the week. I titled like The Bold and Neutral, a little playoff of a soap opera if you're old enough to know. So The Bold, meaning the Fed went kind of pretty aggressive in terms of how they, at least, 50 bips, and when they could have done 25, they could have justified 25. Once that happened, this endless debate for about a year of like, when is the Fed going to start cutting rates and also by how much, that's resolved. So now you pivot to the next debate. And the next debate is the terminal rate, how much the Fed's going to cut. We'll get to like what you think that will be, but it's sort of almost a precursor to that. And this is the neutral kind of discussion. It's like, and then you also used the phrase I like, it's the next phase. I'd say it's the next stage, but like we are now in maybe the final stage of the post-pandemic normalization.
Right.
We had huge dislocations. Inflation went up. The Fed raised rates. Inflation's come down. Now they can cut.
Right.
The question is like, what is the post-pandemic economy look like? What is normal, neutral in this environment? I have my views. I'm a little more on the more optimistic side that things could actually be better than people assume. We're not going back to the pre-pandemic lower for longer regime.
Right.
But as you, especially when you have to make these investments that are going to be longer term, what's your thinking, like what the U.S. economy specifically, but even maybe kind of globally, what's it going to look like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line?
Right. Well, a lot can obviously happen in the next 3 to 5 years. But I think it's pretty consistent with what you're saying, which is that there's not a lot of slack in the economy today, right? I mean, the labor market might be moderating, but it's still in the 4% range. On unemployment. You do have all this IT and capital spend that's happening. You do have, supply chains being made more robust. You do have, if you look at the real estate market, you don't have, what you typically have in this part of the cycle, which is much higher vacancies outside of office, and you have new supply coming down. So all this, not a lot of excesses and the potential for demand to move you to a higher growth, but also a more inflationary environment out a few years. And, to us, that, again, where we are today, where that leads you to is not a bad environment. It's actually a really interesting and exciting environment to be investing. And that's why to us in the beginning of this year, we said, you know, now is the time to be leaning in and to be investing. And to look at our activity, our deployment has gone, you know, significantly up. But not, you know, we are, as large as we are not an index investor. We're highly concentrated, highly thematic in our investing. And we are that way because obviously if you are in this environment where you have better growth but some more inflation and maybe not going back to this lowest rate environment that we were in, you really, you're not counting on, you know, multiples. You're counting on cash flow growth and being in the right neighborhoods. You know, we're very focused on investing in the best neighborhoods and the companies where through intervention or through other opportunities, you can drive outsized cash flow growth. And that's why, you know, we look at our portfolio, whether it's in real estate or private equity or credit, you know, it's concentrated in certain areas. In real estate, you know, 75% of our global real estate portfolio is in logistics, rental housing, and data centers, right? We're less than 2% in U.S. office buildings. And these are areas that we believe we've got long-term tailwinds on the macro side, and they're ways to drive outsized cash flow growth. If you look at where we're lending in the credit business, whether it's, you know, business services or software technology or healthcare or insurance, again, these are sectors that we believe are more robust and more resilient and will perform better and have performed better through these environments if you're, you know, if you're in the current environment or if you're in this, you know, higher growth or you know, back to a more inflationary environment.
Earlier in the year, I think it was in April, I published a note I titled the 6% economy, 6% referring to nominal GDP growth. That, you know, like the past few years, we've been above that. In the 1990s, it was close to 6%. I don't think we'll get there, but the last decade was 4%. I think this decade it's going to be more, and we are cracking more at 5%, which leads into kind of just thoughts on rates going back to, like, you're making these investments, you're in, you know, equity or real estate credit. You have to obviously be making a view on sort of where the Fed is going to go, the terminal rate. Market pricing for the Fed funds rate in December of next year is 2.89%. That's pricing some probability of recession, so it's probably not what the market thinks in a soft landing. But as you think about this environment you're talking about, what kind of real estate interest rate assumptions are you assuming for the Fed and even the 10-year for that matter?
Well, when we're making our investments, we're really not depending on, you know, certain number of rate cuts in a certain time period, right? We're looking more towards, you know, where do we have the highest conviction in terms of, you know, underlying fundamentals and, again, ability to, you know, drive cash flows and have better performance. And if you look at where we're investing, for example, if you want to use the real estate space or even, you know, more broadly, if you want to look at, you know, what we're doing in the data center space, you know, we just see a large opportunity to have this, you know, really outsized demand met with a more limited supply and a lot of growth opportunity. And that's what we've been seeing. And that expands beyond just data centers into the broader AI, big data. Hopefully we'll talk more about that. Same thing, if you look at what we're investing in the real estate space, which is really concentrated in rental housing, and logistics, which are sectors where, you know, again, vacancy rates today are in the mid single digits, actually, in back to data centers below 2%. And if you look at logistics, you look at rental housing, new supply is down, you know, 40-70%. So when you look forward, you got limited vacancy today, you got supply coming down. That, you know, argues for very positive underlying supply-demand dynamic fundamentals. We do see, again, this inflation continuing to come down. It does feel like it's not like a one-and-done rate cut, so that will continue. You know, where that rests, you know, it's really, I don't view our investments dependent on where that rests and where that, you know, 10-year finally settles. And there's obviously a range of where that could be.
So this maybe sort of answers the kind of the next question I had, which is, we look at real estate activity, but I also look at, you know, private equity activity, other corp M&A in general, so not, you know, transactional activity. Right. It's by a number of metrics been pretty muted for the past couple of years. You know, as the Fed raised rates, concerns about the economy. One of my thoughts before that's going to pick up, you first need some clarity on the direction of travel for rates. Because, like, simple, like, what is your NAV? Well, am I assuming a 10-year at 3%, 4%, 5%? Right. I mean, so there's that as an input. Right. And it feels like, well, at least we know it's not going higher. Right. We have sort of a near-term kind of a path going forward. So that would start to open up some activity. Sure. The other thing would be, like, you know, if you're in a boardroom, if it's like you're making long-term decisions, M&A, it's like, what is my view on the economy?
Right.
There's still some uncertainty there. 3 months, 6 months, that could kind of, you know, change. So now you have a situation where, all right, the Fed's cut rates 100 basis points by the turn of the year. Clear that soft landing is the playbook.
Right.
These would be conditions that start to unlock a lot of activity.
And it has.
And, and so that's my conjecture. It does seem like some of the data is ticking higher.
Yeah.
I mean, what would your I mean, in your, because when you say that, you know, we're not so dependent on rates, but when you see in general this activity, does it feel like everyone's been waiting and now this is the first hurdle and we get a couple more and it's going to really accelerate for next year? Or is it more of like a gradual pickup? How would you think?
Well,
this...
you know, our activity's picked up quite meaningfully. So, I mean, in the first half of the year, actually, if you look at just the last quarter across the firm, we deployed or committed $50 billion of capital, which is the highest amount of deployment that we've had. Or commitment and deployment we've had in 2 years. And if you look at real estate, I think it was $15 billion of deployed in the first half of the year, $10 billion in the last quarter alone. Again, I think up 2.5 times from a year prior. So, you know, we said at the beginning of the year, if you want to use real estate as an example, you know, we said two things. We view real estate values as bottoming and now being the time to invest. And the reason for that was, you know, you did have a lot of negative sentiment across real estate, mainly because of rising interest rates and all the negative headlines on office buildings. And to us, we did have a view from what I said earlier about, you know, a resilient but slowing economy, inflation coming down, and that, you know, leading to cuts happening. And we also had clarity that not all commercial real estate is an old office building. And, you know, the vacancy of 20%+ in office, very different from low, mid single digits in other sectors. And we saw, you know, future supply coming down quite meaningfully. So all of that to us suggested that, you know, before the all clear sign, now is a time to invest. And that was back in January. And if you look at those two things we said, you know, real estate values bottoming and time to invest, you know, since that time, you look at the private market real estate indices, look at Green Street or others, it's been stable to increasing. You look at obviously the public REITs. The public REITs have had, you know, a nice increase this year. I think it's 12-13%. I think even double that in the apartment space. If you look at our portfolio and our activity, our transaction activity, when we're selling assets, when we're selling apartments, we're selling logistics, more and more buyers showing up and that price firming and increasing as well. So that feels like it has been happening. Again, let's set office aside. It's another kind of whole dynamic. But that has been happening. And we have been leaning in and investing. But again, we're not investing across, you know, in some real estate index. We're investing, you know, again, in the rental housing space. We did a privatization of AIR Communities, a $10 billion public apartment company here in the U.S. We did a privatization of Tricon Residential, a single-family rental company, a $7 billion single-family rental company here in the U.S. We, at the end of last year, did a JV with Digital Realty in the data center space, $7 billion development JV with Digital. We just announced that we're going to be purchasing the largest data center company in Asia called AirTrunk. So, again, it's concentrated in these places where, you know, again, we see strong underlying fundamentals, growth prospects, and also where we see good value today, because the sentiment, you know, now we're starting to see this broad negativity against real estate start to that fog start to lift as rates come down, as there is, I think, a recognition that not all real estate is the same and where you invest does matter. But it's been, you know, with the sentiment differs from reality, you know, is when we typically find these type of investment opportunities and we lean in the most. And that is what we've been doing. As you know, there hasn't been as much clarity, I think, in the market as we've had in what we're seeing from our portfolio and the underlying strength in some of the sectors, whether it's real estate or credit or otherwise. And that's what's really led us, again, not just in real estate, but in our credit business. And you saw us make an announcement just yesterday in the software business and our private equity business as well. And you're seeing transaction activity has picked up and I think will continue to be higher across the rest of the year.
You mentioned like one of the deals, I think, was a data center in Asia.
Yeah.
So a lot of what we talked about right now, at least on the economy, is U.S. specific. There was a period of time earlier in the year of like U.S. exceptionalism. U.S. was doing well. The rest of the world wasn't.
Right.
The U.S. it's kind of converged, and certainly the central bank path is converging. We also, just in the past couple of days, have gotten some announcements out of China in terms of easing of monetary policy.
Right.
Reports overnight still kind of digesting like, is this also a fiscal packaging? That's TBD in terms of like some of the details. You can see, I think the markets are responding, you know, public markets are responding favorably. To, like, if they're doing significant stimulus, that could be benefit globally. But there's definitely been a U.S. versus kind of the rest of the world's kind of dynamic, at least to some extent this year from a macro perspective. When you think about the opportunities, I know you'll invest globally, but how do you see maybe like the U.S. versus Europe, where I think there's probably more pessimism right now, China, which has had some troubles, like from a regional perspective, you know, different things that are interesting in areas that are still a little more kind of challenging might take longer.
Sure. So, I mean, if you look around the world, we have been active in the U.S., but we also have a European and an Asia business, right? And if we can maybe start furthest away in Asia, and then in Asia where we've been particularly active and positive is India. And India is a place where it's the world's fastest growing major economy. They have a growing middle class. They have a young population, average 28 years old, 10 years younger than you have here in the U.S. You've been getting a manufacturing boost from what's happening globally with supply chain shifts. And you just had, a robust opportunity set. We've been there for 19 years now, and we've been really active in our private equity and real estate business. Actually, if you look at the total assets, real estate, private equity that we've invested in since we've been there, it's $50 billion over $50 billion worth of assets there. And we've had a lot of success. And we continue to see a lot of opportunity building businesses and, again, in these sectors that we're more positive on. So we've been positive on India. We continue to be positive investing in India. I'd say Japan is another place. We've been a long time, both private equity and real estate, a number of investments and continue to invest and see opportunities there. There you have, I'd say a renewed dynamism and structural change happening, which is quite exciting in Japan. And we've had a lot of success with our investments in that country as well. If we move closer here, if we go to Europe. Europe's never been a strategy based on outsized growth, right? I mean, Europe, last year in particular, if I go back to real estate, Europe actually was more than half of our real estate investing last year. And it wasn't because, we thought Europe was going to be the growth engine, but you had the negative sentiment broadly across real estate, like I talked about earlier. But then you had an additional negative sentiment about Europe with worse inflation or worse growth issues. And seeing through that, we saw, still good opportunities. Again, if you look at logistics, very healthy logistics fundamentals and a lot of motivated sellers and just a lot of really attractive buying opportunities. And we continue to see that today, whether it's in our real estate business where we've been investing in continue on the logistics, or we actually just confirmed that we're going to be doing a data center development in Northern England or in the hospitality space there or in the residential space. So we're pretty broad in real estate and the credit business too, a lot of really interesting credit opportunities. So for different reasons, different dynamics, but opportunities in Europe and in Asia and here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think India, growth opportunity, Europe, maybe less about the growth.
Not about growth. A lot of opportunity.
A lot of opportunity.
Yeah.
You mentioned data centers a number of times and obviously tied to AI, the amount of money and the amount of investment that's going into AI. But it's not just, data centers to run computers that have semiconductors produced by certain companies.
Right.
It is like some of the announcements of, companies like partnering with, Microsoft with 3 Mile Island. Now you need energy. So the whole AI story, it's not just semiconductor companies. It's then real estate, data centers. It is power production, among other areas. And there could be things that I'm not thinking about.
Yes.
So when you think of, and you mentioned that kind of, you think invest thematically, AI is clearly one of the biggest themes. So how do you think about it then?
So we think about it in really in that context, which is that, with AI and big data today and really, building the highway system of the 21st century. And for us, when we've been focused on investing in AI, a lot of it's been really an AI infrastructure. So, and you could start with, the data centers. And we bought this company, QTS, as a public company. We privatized for $10 billion 3 years ago. And already that company and its lease portfolio is up 7 times in just the last 3 years. And that's an insight. And when we see just the robustness in demand there, which I think people aren't, totally surprised by the strength because everybody's talking about AI in just about every conversation. But, by the way, it's not just AI, it's cloud migration and the need for data storage as well. And you can look at the growth stats, total data creation and storage doubling every 3 years or whatever it is. And it all drives demand for data centers. And it is somewhat analogous to what we saw in logistics. Our portfolio has shifted, a lot over the years. And for the last 14, 15 years, logistics has been a big theme, really driven by e-commerce shifting the whole utility and demand profile for this asset class. And data centers, had already been seeing a shift from cloud migration, now seeing an even bigger shift from AI and the demands that that puts on for data center space. And again, you can see it in the vacancy rates, less than 2% across the U.S., less than 1% in Northern Virginia, which is the biggest data center market in the world. And then we see it, we see just how strong this demand is through the business that we own, again, on QTS. And that gave us the confidence to, you know, enter into the joint venture with Digital Realty, to buy this Asia data center company, AirTrunk, and to really be leaning in into this space. And then, to your point, we say, okay, it's not just buying and building these data centers. What else is part of this AI big data ecosystem where there are attractive opportunities? And by the way, it's attractive not just from the demand side, but also the supply side. You know, it's not so easy to build a data center, right? Power, you talked about. Power is quite limited, is obviously a headline topic. And you mentioned Three Mile Island and the lengths that people are going to secure the power. So that's a limitation. You know, having the expertise, having the tenant relationships, and capital. These are large capital-intensive projects, you know, multi-billion dollar projects in many cases. So, you know, you have demand accelerating, supply being limited, obviously. That's why you're seeing such low vacancies, and you've seen really robust rent growth there. But again, it doesn't end with just building and buying the data centers. You got to finance the data centers. There's opportunities there for our credit business. And then there's everything that goes into the data center. There's the battery storage. There's the backup generators. There's the cooling equipment. There's obviously all the servers that obviously everyone knows NVIDIA, but it's not just NVIDIA. There's companies like CoreWeave, which packages a lot of the servers and basically leases out compute time to help you know, help other companies do that computation and build their large language models. And there's a data, there are all the services related businesses and construction businesses to build the data centers. So there's a lot that goes on within the box, and then obviously outside of the box, you touched on power, because these data centers are, you know, delivering steady power, and power is in short supply, right, compared to the demand. So power generation, power transmission, power distribution, there's a whole world of opportunities there, whether it's our infrastructure business, our energy business, different parts of our private equity business, where, again, there are opportunities. And part of what we do at Blackstone is we see something that others don't see, and we then say, okay, what are the different opportunities for us to invest into that space? And, you know, it's more picks and shovels in infrastructure than, you know, picking which are the winners in the different applications.
So I have kind of one more question I want to follow up on this.
By the way, the numbers are huge. I mean, it's like $1 trillion plus over the next 5 years in AI infrastructure. So it's a very big opportunity set to be investing into.
So it's enormous. The numbers keep getting kind of revised.
And they keep getting bigger.
But then there are definitely AI skeptics out there, which some of the calls have gotten a little louder over the summer, like more on like, all this money, like $1 trillion, could be spent.
Right.
Where's the revenue? Where's the revolutionary change?
Right.
And so there's a concern, like, you know, is this like the 90s where like, there's all this investment? And then we know the bubble burst. Long term, true, but you could have an overdone. Right. So, more from your perspective, and like, I welcome your view on it, but also like, that is a risk. You know, that are things, is this ramping up too much? Are you building data centers, which by the time they come online, is like the demand suddenly falling off? Like, how do you sort of manage that aspect of it?
Well, a couple of things. One is when we're building the data centers, we're not speculatively building and then leasing, they're leased and then built. So you're having long-term leases with very strong credit companies. So that is a de-risking that happens before you're even building these data centers. And when we're talking to the tenants or the companies that are investing the capital, they are more concerned with underspending than overspending into the space. And we are believers that this is transformative. And there is this question on revenue. And we do keep a close eye on is any of this shifting or changing. But for us, we do feel that, you know, the approach, which is, you know, the limitation is the space that these and the data center space that these tenants can get. And we're, again, signing these, you know, long-term 15, 20 plus year leases with these companies before we're starting the construction. That's where, you know, the big capital dollars are being invested on our side. And then once you have those leases signed, that obviously de-risks the investment meaningfully.
Right. Okay, well, we'll see how this plays out. And it's a fascinating sort of, you know, I think for all of us, given the impact on our personal lives, but just like how...
And how we use it. I mean, you know, we've been focused on AI and big data and how we can not just invest in it, but use it for almost a decade now at the firm, and we have 50 data scientists at the firm, and it's also how we can employ it, you know, at Blackstone, at our portfolio companies to operate better, to give us better insights when we're making investment decisions or asset management decisions or operating across the firm and across the business. And we are starting to see more and more application, you know, it feels like every week. So
that's tricky. I think we kind of have to wrap up, but that's a good ending note, cliffhanger, so to speak, to, you know, have a future conversation, because part of my sort of roaring 20s thesis is that ultimately there has to be productivity gains.
Yes.
And AI is a key component of that. The question is how much, when, because if it's 10 years from now, that doesn't fit with the roaring, that's roaring 30s, not roaring 20s. But yeah, hearing how people are doing, is this actually starting to have a material impact? I mean, TBD, but I, you know, as time goes on, we will, I think, as soon as maybe next year, to get a little more evidence of like how that's playing out.
It feels like we're very early stage scratching the surface on that. And as you scratch the surface, it's pretty amazing what the capabilities are. And it feels like whether it's in our business or in drug discovery and all sorts of different parts of the economy, to your point, productivity and innovation enhancement. I mean, the world is a dynamic place. And that's, to me, what makes our business so exciting to invest in. I mean, you mentioned interest rates and the impact and having to factor that in when we're making investment decisions. And obviously, we do that. And we feel like we're conservative in our exit multiples or exit cap rates and allow for a range of interest rate environments to still have a successful investment that we're making. But we're much more focused on, you know, where do we see, you know, the changes happening in this world? We're in a dynamic world. We've seen a lot of change. If you look at our, again, my background is more real estate. So if you look at our real estate business over the last 20 years, you know, when I started at Blackstone and up until the GFC, you know, our business was basically office buildings and hotels. We are over 60% U.S. office buildings in 2007. Today, we're less than 2% U.S. office buildings in our global real estate portfolio. And we're, again, 75% in data centers, rental housing, and logistics. And if we hadn't made that shift, well, you probably wouldn't be talking to me, and we'd be in a very different place with our business. So, and that'll continue to evolve. And, you know, data centers isn't the only thing we're investing in, but it's a really exciting area because there's a lot of change and a lot of shift happening. Yeah. Now, you got to be careful. Trees don't grow to the sky. The world could change. You know, the CapEx or the appetite to invest could change. But this is a shift that we are seeing happening. And for us, we want to be in front of that, and we want to see how can we best capture that opportunity. And we see just, you know, in that whole ecosystem, and not just there. Again, rental housing, we see it in our credit business. We see opportunities in the private equity business. But you see us concentrating, again, in these best neighborhoods, and we see it evolve. And by the way, we see it evolve in terms of who we're serving as well. You know, predominantly institutional investors for most of our history, but now individual investors as well. And how can we serve this broader investor base and deliver the same kind of you know, mission of delivering the best returns we can. And part of that is continuing to innovate and continuing to find these new opportunities.
It is like going back to the interest rate comment. There's maybe the typical playbook of interest rates change. It could have knock-on effects for the industry. I'm sort of thinking it's actually people have to think about the reverse causality, meaning there's all this change that's impacting the economy on a very macro level that actually could change what interest rates
are.
So it's not the tail wagging the dog. It's, you know, the other way around. And that's something I think people aren't thinking about, but it's like, again, it goes like, what is this regime over the next 2, 3, 5 years? I think that's the way to think about things, not...
That's how we think about it. And then again, if you're in that environment, you want to be in these places where you have this outsized growth, where you're not relying on that rate environment and that multiple, that you're in these sectors where you have this outsized growth, where you see whether it's from a macro shift or tailwind or intervention opportunity or other possibilities to drive outsized growth in the environment. And that really reaffirms, you know, lessons that we've learned over many years, which is you really want to concentrate in these best neighborhoods.
I think we could talk about this for hours, but Dan has kind of given me...
Well, the time went quick. I knew it would, but Ken, Jason, this has been terrific. Thank you both again for spending some time with our listeners, our clients. Very productive. We hit on a wide range of topics, top of mind for our listenership base, our clients. So it was great being able to do this, and we do look forward to a follow-up conversation at some point. That would be great.
Would love it.
Great. Thank you for joining us today, Ken.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.